www.heritagesociety.org.
This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
Also listen online at kpft.org. Just go there and hit the listen live button. And if you aren't already there, you're not in Houston, you probably can't benefit from that piece of advice anyway. I have a lot of information on this show tonight on my website, thinkwingradio.com. Also at thinkwing.org, they'll take you to the same place. If you look at today's show, there are a lot of links that I think will be useful and informative either during or after you listen. First thing I will say is we are one day away from the deadline for signing up for Obamacare if you want to be covered by February 1st. There is a second and actual drop-dead deadline, February 15th, if you want to be covered by March 1st. Beyond that, if you want to sign up for Obamacare or change how you're covered or your family is covered, at the point after February 15th, it would take what they call a change of status, meaning you lose your job, your spouse loses their job, a child is born, there's a divorce, whatever the situation is. And this is true of pretty much every medical plan I've ever heard of. If something like that happens that changes your family status, your health status in that way, you can then make mid-year changes. So along the lines of, oh boy, this microphone is in a bad place. Everywhere I look, it's in the way. Okay, today we are going to have a topic and a guest. My guest is Dr. Janice Werbinski. She's an OBGYN from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and the executive director for the Sex and Gender Women's Health Collaborative. That is a national organization of women's health clinicians, and her organization is trying to influence the way physicians, pharmacists, and other healthcare workers are educated in order to better take care of their female patients. This has nothing to do specifically with LGBT or sex medicine. It is specifically about the way we do research, how we apply it, and how it affects essentially non-male patients. So, Dr. Werbinski, or Dr. Janice, if I may call
That's
you
fine.
That.
Yes.
So tell us, first of all, about your group, the Sex and Gender Women's Health Collaborative, and why it's important.
Well, the group started about 6 years ago as a committee of the American Medical Women's Association, and it tends to be that women physicians are more interested in giving a different type of health care to women. And out of this committee grew this web library that we've created of sex and gender specific materials. And the more that we research, the more we find there are lots of differences between men and women in the way we look for disease, the way we treat disease. And it became very clear to us that we now have 25 years of research that has included women through the NIH Revitalization Act passed in 1993, but we still aren't teaching it adequately enough to really make a difference in the lives of women.
Now, that actually raises the next question, which is, why is there a need for discussion of health care in terms of sex and gender? And you and I have discussed the difference between what is technically sex and what is technically gender and why chromosomes make the difference.
Yes.
Oh, and by the way, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. We will be taking phone calls a little later in the program, so you can call in and wait for about 10 minutes or so until we start taking comments and questions, or you can call in 10 or 15 minutes. The phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. And now, before I so rudely interrupted you.
That's okay. Basically, there's a difference between sex and gender, and sex really indicates which chromosomes you're born with. So you're either XX or XY, and there are some variants of that. But your gender really is how you define yourself or how society defines you in the society. So, for example, someone XY who's a man can't get ovarian cancer, and someone who's XX can't get prostate cancer. So those are defined by your sex, but your gender may also define your healthcare risks, such as the women in Africa who take care of their family members with Ebola are more likely to die from Ebola, and that's a gender issue because by their gender alone, they are the persons who are taking care of those people with Ebola.
So you have chromosomal sex and societal gender assignment.
Yes.
Now, let me ask you a question. In the opening introduction, we talked about the fact that your organization is not about LGBT issues or sexual medicine, and yet, with transgenders becoming more common and more open in terms of how they're treated in society, you've got a chromosomal situation and you've got a hormonal situation. That, from a medical standpoint, a clinical standpoint, how is there a protocol for that? or how is that viewed clinically?
Well, several organizations are working toward having more awareness toward LGBT health. But our feeling, our stand is that if we don't already even take into account the chromosomal differences, how are we ever going to face the differences in LGBT? So that's definitely something that we need to work on, but we really feel it's basically important to work on the sex and gender differences first.
We have discussed that currently what we're effectively practicing is one sex, or as I termed it on my announcement, unisex medicine. Most research is done on male animals. There are both political and economic reasons for that. But it comes with certain complications when you start looking at true, individually appropriate medical treatment, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, there's a study that was done on male mice on blood pressure treatment. And they found when they started using the female mice, it actually gave the absolute opposite effect. And so we know now that 8 out of 10 drugs removed from the market are removed for side effects in women, because most of the studies have included men and male animals, and the outcomes have been reported in men. And we really don't get an adequate number of women involved until they're actually the guinea pigs out there who are taking the prescribed medication that's already been FDA approved.
Now, we were talking before the show that what we're discussing here about gender differences in research, gender differences in clinical trials, etc., there are two other aspects to that that really need to be talked about, which is the political aspect and the financial aspect. The political aspect is when our government funds research, there is a political decision at what level to fund it, where the priorities are. Biology is often shortchanged, is what I keep hearing. And then there's the financial aspect, which is, and actually another political aspect, if I may go back, is also treatment of animals, that all of the animal rights organizations have created an awareness that makes institutions, both by law and by preference, try to minimize the use of animals, to try to minimize the objectionability, if you will, of using animals for research. On top of that, having two genders means that if you were to do basic research on both genders, you're essentially doubling the number of animals that you would have to use. Aside from the political issues involved in that, that's a very costly thing. I think my wife tells me that it costs her something like 50 cents a day to house an animal. That doesn't sound like a lot until you start multiplying it by the number of animals and the number of days. And along with that comes the chow requirements and the data analysis. And I'm not saying that all of this makes your issue invalid, but it gets very complicated. Essentially, what it comes down to is politics and money in a way, doesn't it?
It does. But, you know, my short answer to that is, so what? It's so important that, you know, sometimes women are dying because the differences are not taken into account. So, and I would disagree that we have to double the number of animals. We just have to split them 50-50, men and male and female.
But if you split the animals 50-50 without increasing the number of animals, what you end up with is a statistically invalid result. So you have to have a certain number of animals in each cohort. See, I've done some of this reading.
Yeah, I understand. And I have been a researcher, too. But I don't think that it means you have to double it. And I still say, you know, what do we spend on one stealth bomber? I think it's a matter of priorities.
Don't you ever feel sorry for that poor stealth bomber?
I know. Just one of them.
$2 billion. Of course, that's the amortized price, including development. But that poor bomber, everybody picks on that poor bomber.
Well,
it's a good thing it doesn't have feelings.
I think it matters where our priorities
what
are.
What is the NIH research budget? Do you have any idea off the top of your head? Or would you ballpark it?
Nope, not off the top of my head.
I should have known that information.
It's actually on your website because I was looking at it today.
It is, eh? I should be reading my website at thinkwingradio.com or thinkwing.org.
Well, you were showing the trends of how much we spend now than we used to.
I actually think I printed that out.
Yeah.
Hold on a second. Okay, here we go. So in 2000, now this is adjusted dollars. In 2000, it looks like there was about $28 billion ballparking off the chart that was spent. That peaked in 2003-2004 at about $38 billion, and the equivalent now is about $31 or $32 billion, I would say. So it comes out to about a 20% reduction over the last 11 years.
Right.
But that's in spite of the fact that we have population growth, and you would think that you would have to be putting in more money.
But, you know, I'd kind of like to get off of just research as being the important thing here.
Sure, that's true. I mean, it is an aspect of the battle.
We do have 25 years of research that has included women, and we're still not teaching those differences. Women are still coming to the emergency room with jaw pain or fatigue or nausea, which is a symptom of an MI in women.
An MI.
And myocardial infarction, a heart attack. And
really? So jaw pain
absolutely.
In women.
My mother had a heart attack, and her only symptom was jaw pain, and no one recognized it.
Okay, so now that is interesting because that's one of the key issues, one of the key points you try to make, is that the standard idea of a heart attack is left arm pain. Chest pain, left arm pain.
Not standard, male.
Male. Well, but it is considered the standard.
Yes.
So I've never heard that before. That's how under the radar that is.
Well, and there has been an educational campaign through the Health and Human Services to try to increase that awareness.
Hmm.
You know, that heart disease is the number one killer of women, and the symptoms may appear differently, and women don't even recognize it in themselves.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and Egberto Willis here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. We will take phone calls with questions or comments. The phone number is 713-526-5738, otherwise known as 713-526-KPFT. And we are talking about sex and gender in healthcare. My guest is Dr. Janice Werbinski, Executive Director of the Sex and Gender Women's Health Collaborative, an organization of women's health clinicians trying to educate the public and medical personnel about the differences in treating men versus women. One of the articles that you sent me that I linked on my site is entitled, Analysis of Sex Differences Reveals an Immunosuppressive Role for Testosterone in Response to Influenza Vaccine. Now, in some ways, that would also argue that dual gender research might also be of benefit to men. Because the fact
absolutely.
That there is that distinction means there's something there to investigate.
Absolutely. And even though we are titled the Women's Health Collaborative, this is going to improve men's health just as much as women's. Men get breast cancer and don't realize it when they have a lump that they should be looking for breast cancer.
Yeah. There is. What is the percentage of breast cancer sufferers who are male? It's small. It's like 5%.
Yeah. It's less than 5%.
But the fact that it is 5%, you know, if I had 5% odds of winning the lotto, I would play more often.
That's right.
Kind of the kind of comment I make to that. About that particular study about the immunosuppressive role of testosterone, in the significance section, part of it says there are marked differences between the sexes in their immune response to infections and vaccination, with females often having significantly higher responses. But the mechanisms underlying these differences are largely not understood. Males, which is, of course, the point of doing research to better understand, males with the highest testosterone levels and expression of related genes exhibited the lowest antibody responses to influenza vaccinations. And the study generates a number of hypotheses on the sex differences observed in the human immune system, et cetera.
So in the vernacular, what that means is we only need to give women half the amount of immunization dose as men to get immunized against the flu. Think of the money we would save if the dose that we pay for a man could be given to two women.
And there are also the health consequences of giving a higher dosage than is clinically necessary. Sometimes that itself can create problems and side effects and reactions.
True.
We have our first caller on the line, Judith. You're on the air. How are you doing today?
Just fine, thank you.
So what would you like to talk about on our topic today?
Well, I understand Dr. Werbinski's concern for doctors, but why is this important for the general population to be concerned about it?
Well, the first thing that would come to mind for me is half the general population is female.
True.
So that would be my first comment. But Dr. Jan?
Well, and the reason we are reaching out to the lay population is because they are in a position to make a grassroots change here with us. We're trying to work from the top down, but if women who go to pick up their prescription or go to their doctor ask that question, is this different in women? Has this been studied in women? Are there different side effects in women? The answer may be, I don't know, but it'll...
Or I don't know and I'll find out.
Yes, but it may increase the awareness and the research into looking at those differences.
And I think that's an important part of personal research. You know, if you're going to buy a car or a refrigerator, you're going to do a lot of personal research before you acquire that product. When you go to a doctor, half the battle isn't necessarily knowing what the answers are. It's knowing what the questions are. So if you know that a question should be, I'm female, should I be getting the same dosage that a full-grown man should be getting? I weigh two-thirds of what a man does. Should my dosage be less, or what are the side effects for this for women versus men? Knowing the questions, even if you don't know the answers, becomes half the battle.
Absolutely.
What do you think, Judith?
Well, it seems kind of obvious now. I never think that because I always just presume the doctor knows best.
Don't we all?
And that the doctor is looking at me as a woman. And I never think he's giving me the same pill that he's giving the man in the next room. And, you know, so it is kind of interesting to think that I would be able to question him or her, and maybe they'd think a little differently.
Well, the catch-22 here is that doctors, even if they're very knowledgeable, base their knowledge on the clinical evidence and the published results. And if the published results just say what they say, they may never even start to think about, well, but was there a gender difference that wasn't discovered because all they used were single-gender cohorts?
Right. And I was just wondering how much, Doctor, that your group is working with the pharmaceutical companies, you know, even before it gets to the doctors.
Well, it's kind of hard to work into the pharmaceutical companies, but one of the things that we are working very hard on is the educational venues of the pharmacists to try to get the information into their literature and their educational areas. If we have time, I was going to give the example of the Ambien dosage difference that has been changed by the FDA. After Ambien was released on the market, it was found that a lot of women were driving impaired and having accidents. And when they started doing blood levels on women, they found that they metabolize Ambien much slower than men.
So it isn't just a body mass issue.
No. It's a whole different in their biology. And so the FDA did rightly look at that and make universal changes to the dosages. And it's actually the only drug on the market that has a different dosage for men and women.
What's interesting is I take the generic Ambien, the Zolpidem tartrate. My doctor cut my dosage in half. So I guess my feminine side was showing.
I don't know. You know, I'm
so,
not...
So essentially we're still talking about unisex medicine. Just to keep it simple... They ended up diminishing, in the case of my particular doctor, ended up decreasing the male dosage to match the female dosage, I guess, for simplicity's sake?
Well, and it may be that he didn't understand the difference as it was put out, you know, that 10 milligrams is fine for a woman, or is fine for a man, but 5 milligrams is needed for a woman. And maybe he just thought, well, it's probably safer for both sexes that way.
Hmm. Judith, you have any other questions?
No, I think that's it. Thank you, Doctor, and thank you for all the work that you are doing. I think hopefully is going to make a difference for, you know, our children and grandchildren. Hopefully we will begin thinking differently.
Thanks.
I appreciate your calling, Judith. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have open lines. The phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, or as they do it on the music shows, 713-JAM-KPFT. Why is it whenever I think of jam, I think of strawberry
food?
Anyway. So the NIH, as you commented earlier, the National Institutes of Health, mandated in the 1990s, I think by congressional, was it by congressional law, you said?
Absolutely.
That researchers were required to do sex-related research, but not necessarily to report the outcomes, so that after 25 years, even though they're supposed to be doing it, we don't know they're doing it because we don't have published results saying, required to say, and here's how we did it with different cohorts of mice or rats or whatever.
Right. The law only, the law established an Office of Women's Health at NIH, which oversees all research and assures that women are included in all research where it's appropriate. But it didn't go farther enough to say that they had to report the results by sex. So women still remain invisible in a lot of that research. We call that add women and stir.
Women in stir. Okay, I think they've done movies about that.
I don't know.
So one of the questions that is sometimes posed is, don't we already take adequate care of women through the specialty of OBGYN?
Well, you know,
and wouldn't OBGYNs presumed to be more knowledgeable in this area.
Well, you know, that's where we're finding the biggest block in this issue, because we absolutely believe that the education of OBGYNs is adequate and wonderful for reproductive health in women. But what's happened is women have been defined by their reproductive health, and people have forgotten the other organs that are different. Every single cell, every organ has a sex. And so we know that there are lots of differences in hormones and in reproductive areas. But the areas we're trying to emphasize are the kidney, the bowel, the GI tract, the heart, all those, the brain. Depression is very different in men and women. If we did our screening test for depression differently in men and asked different questions, we ask the same questions we ask women. Are you sad? Are you withdrawn? Do you not enjoy things you used to enjoy? That's how women present with depression. Men more often present with violence, abuse, suicide, and substance abuse.
So now that's interesting. So whereas a lot of biology is skewed toward males, we're talking about one clinical specialty that may be skewed more toward females?
Well, yes, because the way that depression is defined today, it's three times more prevalent in women. But that's because we're asking the wrong questions. It's probably as prevalent in men. But men end up being sent to jail for those outbursts, where we're ignoring that symptom of depression in males. And think, you know, if we, all of these men who have done these horrible shootouts in schools and theaters, if we had recognized their depression early enough, maybe we could have instituted treatment and helped prevent some of that.
Okay, that's really interesting. So I'm guessing, you know, in the 19th century, when they began considering psychology and psychiatry as an area of specialization, I guess women were considered the emotional, potentially hysterical sex, and therefore the ones most in need from the male perspective of having their heads sorted out. And somehow now that has actually become perhaps a bias against how they treat and evaluate males?
I think so. Isn't it interesting that a hysterectomy, the removal of a womb, a uterus, is based on hysteria?
Yeah, they come from the same roots, mm-hmm. Verbally speaking. We touched a little earlier, and by the way, open line 713-526-5738, we're taking questions and comments. We talked a little earlier about the LGBT community, transgender, how that creates a really interesting clinical question in the context of what we're discussing here, but also different gender orientations. So how does your organization see its relationship to the LGBT community in terms of goals?
Oh, the goal is the same, to treat people according to their genetics and their social gender. It's very important, but as I said before, unless we first start out with the basic differences, we're never going to get to the more complex differences.
You used a comment earlier, add women and stir, and I should have asked you to elaborate on that earlier, but I didn't want to disturb the thread of the discussion. What do you mean by that?
Well,
or is it just a catchy phrase?
No, well, it means that it kind of depicts what's happened at the Office of Women's Health, because we did add women. We added women to the research, but we stirred them in with the pot of men, and the results are all the same. So the results are coming out probably more indicative of men's health, because there are more men still in most research. So it's just a way of saying that the women's outcomes are still invisible, because they've been added and stirred in, but they aren't kept separate.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and Egberto Willis, although he's been a very quiet fellow today, here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My guest is Dr. Jan Werbinski. She's an OBGYN physician and executive director of the Sex and Gender Women's Health Collaborative, organization of women's health clinicians trying to influence the way physicians, pharmacists, and other healthcare workers are educated in how to care for women patients as literally distinct from male patients. And we do have open lines if you have questions or comment. The phone number is 713-526-5738. Okay, you have used the term on your website about care or medicine from bench to bedside. What does that mean?
Well, that's a shortened way of saying that the research that we're funding comes out with some outcomes and some answers, and those answers get translated into the education of physicians, and they also get translated into pharmaceuticals, and those products then are delivered to the woman at the bedside. So what we're trying to influence is from bench to bedside, from the researchers' papers to what actually the woman picks up as her prescription or her recommendation for that problem. And everything happens that in between. What happens now is that women are still pretty much invisible in the outcomes. So sometimes women are given the wrong dose of Ambien than what a woman should require.
Or sometimes the man may be given an inadequate dose.
No, it's actually too much for the women because the men's dose is still...
Well, in my particular case, yes. Maybe I should talk to my doctor about getting
you
that
should,
dose
because
re-increased.
Your dose should be
yeah,
the man's
so.
Dose.
or at least the last time I looked. Our earlier caller asked about why the pharmaceutical companies are not more interested in this. That actually raises kind of an interesting tactical question because their business, of course, is to make money. You know, one of the questions that most researchers face, do I go into pharmaceuticals or do I go into collegiate research? And the pharmaceuticals pay better, but you can't publish your work. You research what they tell you to research, and no matter how interesting the results are, if they don't see a potential profit in it, they will just tell you to discontinue the whole project and you have to move on to something else. So it comes down to a matter of money or professional satisfaction. It would seem that a strategy that one might utilize is to persuade pharmaceutical companies that there is an enormous market, 50% or a fraction thereof more of the population, that might in fact be a specific market for specific medications that may in fact not be necessary for men, but you've got 50% of the market that they might be appropriate for.
Absolutely. Our group has actually considered approaching Pfizer, who manufactures the Ambien, the Zolpidem, and pointing out to them the 60 Minutes segment that was done by Leslie Stahl about
which I
this.
Have a link on that on my
yes.
site.
And, you know, maybe raising their awareness that that's something that they can start marketing, that they are the only drug on the market that has different recommendations for men and women.
And that could actually be a sign that there is a whole market not only for different dosages, which in some cases might mean a higher dosage to the male, which might mean more money because it always mm-hmm. costs more to get a bigger dosage, but also the fact that there may be an untapped market there for specific problems for women that men are not afflicted with because of anatomical differences, hormonal differences, neurological differences. There may be a whole market there that they haven't even touched for half the population for drugs that men don't need at all.
And almost every pharmaceutical company has a women's health segment, but it's still mostly limited to reproductive health, like contraception and hormones.
What would be the role for medical schools?
Oh.
Oh! Thank God you're
We get to the point. That's the biggest point. Our group has decided to choose medical schools as the first place to try to influence. And that's because it is so needed to get this education into the schools. And medical school is where there is actually a curriculum written down that is to be followed. We certainly need it in practicing physicians and in residents and interns and all other areas and pharmacies too. But we think that medical schools is the place to start because they have organized curricula and they have classes that they have to take. So we're partnering with the Laura Bush Women's Health Institute at Texas Tech, and they have gone way ahead of all the other schools in the United States in creating curricula specifically for sex and gender. And it's not that you have to start a whole new department in your medical school. You just have to add 3 to 4 slides to each lecture you give. Let's say you're giving a lecture on kidney, and just add a few slides about the other sex that you're teaching about.
Medical schools train not only doctors but researchers. There are a lot of doctors who also do research. I'm not going to say on the side precisely, but they divide their time between clinical work and research work, and often one informs the other. At medical schools, I would think that to the extent that they might begin to emphasize the importance of this kind of dual-sex research, that their students might then go on to think of that in ways it's like, oh, yeah, that would be an interesting question to answer. I should try that.
Sure.
Because it's very hard to change the minds of older people. I mean, they are informed by their experience. I don't want to say that older people become rigid, because that's a very individual trait, but you start to feel a little more narrowed in terms of the experiences you've had, the information of which they inform you, etc. Younger people, I think it's more like anything is possible. I haven't seen that this is impossible, therefore it must be possible.
That's right, yeah.
So I would think that that would be perhaps a direction to go to in terms of not only how they train physicians, but also in terms of how they inform physicians' research.
Absolutely. One of the biggest projects we're working on this year is an invitational conference that we're going to hold in October at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and it's an invitational. So we are actually going to pave the way for one curriculum leader or curriculum dean from each U.S. medical school to come and attend, and we will have these teaching tools and these curriculum aids available for free for them to take back to their schools to start teaching these sex and gender differences.
You know, very often people are not closed to ideas, but they have to be exposed to them.
Absolutely.
And then their minds kind of start to work off in new directions. One of our callers asked that we perhaps discuss a little bit more about the difference in heart attack and heart attack symptomology in women. Can you add anything to what you said earlier about, for example, the symptom in the jaw?
Well, it's pretty well known, especially the American Heart Association does promote this in their Red Dress campaign, that the symptoms can be very different. They can be the same, but they can be very different in women. And fatigue is the number one symptom, and jaw pain, pain between the shoulder blades, sweating, those can all be symptoms of heart attack in women. And a lot of emergency room physicians do recognize that now, but the women themselves need to recognize when they're having a symptom.
I guess I'm curious. I mean, we don't really think of male and female anatomy being that drastically different. I mean, you've got all the same, for the most part, you've got all the same organs. They're pretty much in all the same places. You've got some difference in skeletal structure and hormones, obviously. What do you have any notion of what would account for the physical differences in symptoms, like where you feel the pain, whether it's in the jaw, the arm, or the chest, or the back of the shoulder blades? That's really intriguing to me.
Well, there's a lot of research going on showing the differences between heart attack in men and women, and there's a special type of heart attack that occurs in women that's not as common in men, and that's really that there's not a blockage of an artery like there is in a man, a cholesterol blockage, but it's a spasm of the microvasculature. The small vessels in the heart are different in women, and they especially respond to adrenaline and other hormones. And when women undergo the heart cath, they may not see a blockage in the artery. And then because blockages in arteries are so common in men, sometimes the doctor doesn't realize that a spasm in the artery can cause a heart attack as easily in women, and that wouldn't show up in a heart cath. And different type of testing needs to be done in order to elicit that response in the woman's heart.
Now, that's interesting, because what they sometimes call a mini stroke,
transient ischemic attack.
In many cases, when they start to do their various tests, they will find no blockages, in which case the determination is, well, it was probably a vascular spasm.
Right. The same thing can happen in the heart.
Interesting.
Actually, the Barbara Streisand Heart Institute at Cedars in Los Angeles is very active in that research and working on showing those differences in the heart. Maybe we could go back to the medical school issue, too, because I wanted to bring up the international aspects. Other countries are way, way ahead of us in sex and gender medicine. In Australia, there's a medical school that all 4 years is integrated with sex and gender medicine. Sweden has an entire institute devoted to sex and gender medicine. There are sex and gender societies of Israel, Italy, all the different countries. In the United States, the only school that I'm aware of that pays attention and teaches sex and gender differences is Texas Tech in Texas, which is one of the reasons I'm coming to Texas to talk about these issues. The Laura Bush Institute has started an institute which is emphasizing sex and gender differences, and they are teaching it in their medical school now.
What do you think accounts for that difference? I mean, we know that cultures are different and politics in various countries are different. What do you think accounts for the fact that the United States in this area seems to not necessarily be behind per se, although we may in fact be, but takes a totally different view of it that I guess seems to consider it less important?
I missed the question. What schools?
No, not. In other words, there are nations you just pointed out that look more closely in their medical education of students in terms of the differences in treating genders, different sexes.
Yes.
Whereas the United States seems to be more resistant to that institutionally. And I was wondering if you had any idea why the United States, in that sense, may be behind these other countries in this particular area. What is the resistance to it culturally, do you think, or politically?
I don't know.
Good question.
I don't have an answer to that. I wish I did.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and Egberto Willis, the silent man tonight. The phone number, we are taking phone calls, 713-526-5738. I don't think I've done a show where Egberto hasn't made a comment. So that either means he's bored, he's distracted, or I'm doing a really, really good job. Oh, I'm doing a really good job, he says. But he says it without getting online.
You know, okay. I can add one thing.
Yeah.
That it seems that when I talk to physicians in the United States, it seems that they all say, and I have to say, I said this at first when I was approached with this, well, we already do that with the OBGYN department. We fund that, and that's women's health, and that's it's done and over with. And I think the understanding of the sex and gender differences in other organs than the reproductive organs is not there.
We tend to think of it in terms of the reproductive organs, going back to, well, the skeleton is basically the same and the organs are basically the same. It's only the organs that are visibly different that we figure are actually
right.
Different.
Yep.
And apparently it's more interesting and complicated than that.
Oh, very.
We have open line, 713-526-5738, and we have Phil on the line. Phil, how are you doing tonight? You're on the air.
I'm doing great. My question is, since Big Pharma is in medicine itself is always about money, and it's a true fact, I believe, that women go to doctors more than men.
She's nodding her head yes, so
yes.
Apparently you're right.
Okay, it would seem like they would want to focus on who sees the doctor the most, and the doctors would want to do this, but I know they don't, because usually men only go to the doctors when
after
they have
the women
ED,
nag them to.
when they have an ED problem.
Mm. Well,
and
now
maybe that's one of the reasons why, you know, that they only look at, you know, the sexual deal instead of the whole, but women, you know, even in medical school, I believe they're gaining as to the number of women doctors.
Which probably will make a difference in where the concentrations and foci are. I will also point something out. In supermarkets, they understand that there is a radical difference in shopping patterns between men and women. Men will have a list, and they'll go to the different places in the store and fill the list and leave. The packaging, for the most part, is aimed at women, making the packages pretty, making the food pretty. All of us are susceptible to that, but apparently, psychologically, women are much, much more susceptible to sort of roaming and experimenting and being intrigued by the appearance of something. And when you look at that, you start to wonder, well, why haven't the doctors snapped to that? That the women are essentially shopping differently from men, and you can appeal to them more in different ways than you can to men.
Yeah, it would seem that Big Pharma would do it, too, in their packaging of their product, too.
Yeah.
You know, women shop more than men do. Women buy more than men do.
So maybe what we need to do.
I go in there only if I have to. I mean, I'm dragged in there, and they say, okay, you need a new shirt, or you need new jeans, or you need new something.
But who buys the cars?
Yeah, women.
Well, I'll tell you what. Both of you, in a sense, are right, because Dr. Jan was implying men, and Phil said women. And there's an interesting story here regarding General Motors and Ford, going back to the 1920s. Ford used to have a motto. Henry Ford believed that the car was the thing. He was basically a typical male shopper. It got you from here to there. It just needed to run, and it needed to be inexpensive, and it needed to be independable. And he had a famous saying, you can have any color you want as long as it's black.
Right.
The guy who built General Motors from what were actually a bunch of failing car companies, he decided that the best way to differentiate himself from Ford was to add 5 color selections. On the theory that the men may want something that's simply practical and affordable and reliable, but the women will want something pretty. And it took about 75 or 80 years before Ford could make up the difference in sales, that General Motors just took over the market because women were saying, but wouldn't you like that in blue? And of course, Henry Ford, any color you want as long as it's black. If you wanted blue, you had to go to General Motors.
And what you're describing here is actually studied in psychiatry as right brain, left brain. And marketers know that there's different ways that men and women think.
You know, I hate to sound too glib, but there may actually be a grain of truth in this, that maybe when men make up the names of drugs, you know, they come up with drug names that sound intellectual, that sound strong, that sound somehow masculine. Maybe we need to have more feminine drug names. From a pharmaceutical standpoint, they might actually sell better. A prettier name. Ambien, maybe Sleep Pretty.
they have Lunesta.
Lunesta, yeah, that would be kind
with
of a feminine name.
With the butterfly
flitting
by.
Actually, that's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. That would be, to me, I don't know if they were thinking of it at the time, but that would be a very feminine-focused commercial.
Yeah, what I was going to bring up is marketers aren't mostly men, or they're at least 50-50 men and women.
Probably not. It's probably mostly men still.
Really?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, men have longer career paths. One of the obstacles that women face in the job market is that most women have this interruption for childbearing.
But that's changing.
It's changing, but, you know, biology to some extent is destiny. Women have children, and having a child is a hard thing, and typically women take some time off, and bosses don't like that.
But in other countries, they have, you know, paid for child care. They have a lot of things that keep the women in the workplace.
But
Well, it's just like I know from what I've read recently that a lot of the women graduating from college are waiting longer to have children so that they can get their career, get whatever they need to get, and then they have children later on.
That's true.
You know, I'm going to throw out a theory that I have here. There are sometimes discussions about whether humans are still evolving or whether we have arrested or reversed evolution. I don't think you can arrest evolution. Evolution is what it is. It can be good evolution or bad evolution or sideways evolution, but things are changing. Now, you raised the point about women waiting later to have children. I have often wondered if the best way to extend human life expectancy and health expectancy is, in fact, by having children later in life. obviously not for individuals necessarily, but DNA doesn't care about your quality of life or your life expectancy. DNA only cares that you reproduce the DNA. So if you have children later, the people who are successfully having children later, presumably those children may be biologically disposed to being able to have children later. Biology being destiny, it may be possible that the best way to extend life expectancy is for the DNA to say, hell, if I have to wait longer before I can reproduce, I might as well keep them healthy in the meantime. So, it's kind of an interesting question, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it is. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I think I've now burned out my great idea. But I mean,
your great matter's gone, huh?
It's something that I have played with. Because a lot of people talk about, juvenile diabetes. Now that we can treat juveniles with diabetes, they live long enough to reproduce. They have children who are genetically predisposed to having diabetes. From an evolutionary standpoint, that would be a negative. If the technology fails or disappears for some reason, now we have spread that gene to a larger fraction of the population. That's a negative. On the other hand, if you are having children later in life and biology requires that you stay alive and healthy longer so that you can have those children, that would be an evolutionary benefit. You're healthier and live longer because that's how long it takes for the DNA to reproduce itself. It's just kind of an interesting
thing.
Could
be. Interesting.
I appreciate your calling, Phil. Thank you so much. You have anything else you want to mention?
Thank you.
Okay. You take care. We still have a few minutes, and we still have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. I'm debating whether I should wait for Egberto to punch in a name. There you go. Okay, Lee. I was about to go on to another point, but Egberto was fast on the keyboard. So, Lee, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Well, I'll be short and sweet. There was a lie put out. Men don't go shopping. Men go buying. They know what they want. They go get it. You brought that point to the fruition. Women lie. They say they're going shopping, and they're going buying. They get, they go after something.
No, they go shopping.
No, they go buying. They don't shop. They buy. They go out. They bring back stuff they don't want, don't need, because, like you brought up, the packaging is right. Women go buying. Men go shopping.
Women are particularly interested in retail therapy, it seems. Men, not so much.
No, they need that.
Men, you know, it's like the car. I want to go out and drive. The women is like, I wonder if Lohmann's
like
having
I
a sale.
Said, men go buying.
There are gender differences.
And women lie.
Okay, I think
they say they're going shopping, and they're not. They're going buying.
My wife goes shopping, and then she goes buying.
I am sorry, but
no,
both of you are starting to sound like two chauvinists now, okay? You have two women in the office now.
Now we're both being misogynists,
yes,
right?
Yes, both of you.
Okay, Lee, I'm going to let you go before we all get into more trouble. Take care.
And it really is explained by the differences in the brain
makeup. Yeah, and I mean, it's comical. It might be a little offensive if you look at it the wrong way, but, I mean, there are differences. You can't say that men and women are the same. They come from the same species, but they're not the same.
And here's an interesting factoid. They've actually done research on animals where they instill testosterone into the amniotic fluid of a female animal, or they castrate the male animal in utero, and they find that their brains develop the opposite.
You know, they've also done some research on homosexuality.
That's what I was just going to say. And that leads to...
One of the things that they have begun to think is that it may have to do with what hormones are in the womb at a specific point in development that may tilt the neurology in terms of one way or the other. It's all very interesting stuff that really needs research.
More than just hormones, but I think we can't refute that it happens in utero.
Okay, we've got Mark on the line. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, fine, thank you. A great subject matter.
Thank you.
And thank you, Doctor. It begs a question. I was listening to you on the drive home, and I was thinking so many people today in regards to psychiatric issues, whether depression or bipolar and so forth. I mean, this is another angle where maybe psychiatrists need to take a step back and, are these medications that, again, men and women are taken for depression and so forth. I mean, is that a critical concern to really what is effective for a man, you know, versus a woman, a young lady versus a young man. It just
or premenstrual versus postmenstrual. Female.
Sure, absolutely. You know, so many more people. You know, the spectrum of bipolar seems to be getting wider, or depression and so forth. It just seems like so many people are seeking counseling and medication that it almost sounds a little scary that, you know, that some people may be taking standard dosages that maybe not being as effective and, you know, need to be tweaked. It just
You talk about something like Prozac, which is one of the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And, of course, now you get back into male neurological biology versus female neurological biology. How quickly does it have to selectively control the reuptake? Is the serotonin metabolized faster or slower in a male or a female brain? These all get to be very
interesting questions
once you start to dig into them and have your mind kind of tilted.
And the
that
reason
way.
We don't know is because we've added women and stirred. We need to report results by sex, and we will find those answers.
And we need to elect people that are willing to fund the research that will do those things, as well as encouraging researchers to be curious about them. Because curiosity, I mean, it's gotten to be so much about money and funding. I hear about it from my wife all the time and what goes on at where she works. But also, you have to have the curiosity to say, boy, that is really the thing that I want to write a grant application for. That's something that's really intriguing.
Well, and we do see that in curiosity when women come to medical school because, you know, many schools now have a department of women's studies in their undergrad. And some of these women have gone through women's studies, and then they come to medical school and they say, where is your women's studies? You know, where are the differences? They don't see it.
So thank you so much for calling, Mark. You have any other questions or comments?
Just one question real quick, and thank you for taking my call. I've enjoyed this topic immensely. In regards to ethnic diversity or, you know, different ethnic groups, is the standard for, say, for instance, influenza vaccine the same for a man who's of German heritage or Irish or Scandinavian or Italian versus, I mean, are there any delineation, or is that pretty much standard? If you're a man, this is the standard amount that you need, and if you're a woman, you just maybe also think about that in regards to ethnic diversity.
And that's a great question, and the NIH rule isn't only about gender, it's also about other ethnicities, and we have about 30 seconds for you.
Yeah. Well, they haven't established yet a department for other ethnic groups.
But the expectation is out there. It's
absolutely
part of the guidelines.
Yep.
Okay, thanks so much for calling, Mark. I'm glad you've been enjoying the show. I have
had
a good time. Thank you so much, Dr. Jan. I appreciate it. And Dr. Jan's friend for sitting in quietly and picking up my soda bottle when I knocked it over. Okay, we will be back next week when it's time for the winter fundraiser. Yes! So be prepared. Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and Egberto Willis. And I guess the slogan for today is, you don't know the answer until you ask the question.
Language or imagery that may be offensive to some listeners. Discretion is advised. The Federal Communications Commission permits the broadcast of some profanity during hours deemed to be safe harbor, when children are less likely to be listening. KPFT upholds a stricter policy, permitting the broadcast of sensitive material only between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. The FCC forbids the broadcast of some sexual discussions or other suggestive matters, regardless of the hour. If you have any questions or concerns, please call the program director during business hours at 713-526-4000. This is KPFT Houston.
Gia Gia, iZombie Radio, we are on live right here, right now on 90.1 KPFT, Galveston, 89.5, Goodrich, Livingston, 90.3, and Huntsville, 91.9. My man DJ Brio is in the building.
Yeah.
You already know, man, he is waiting for your calls, calling in at 713-526-4000. 5738. Man, I got my man Trey 9 in the building. And this is your DJ, your favorite DJ, DJ Overflow, man. Shout out to everybody listening and tuning in right now. You can also tune in at kpft.org. Shout out to all the prisoners listening to the show, Eyes on Me Radio. Without further ado, y'all, let's get into a mix. Let's get into this music right here, right now. Eyes on Me Radio.
Got old money, running with a whole lot of folk. I'm talking about ex-dealers, ex-fiends, there's a whole lot of dope. I'm talking about ex-killers, ex-thieves, no, it's not a joke. So when I say Christ reigns, though, it's my slate, no, Jehovah got the rope. He'll make your life change.